You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Coal may not be all that popular these days with people concerned about the environment, but that doesn't mean that the coal industry is giving up without a fight, especially not in Wyoming, home of one of the largest coal mines in the world. Richard Martin has looked into what he calls Big Coal's last stand in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. It's nice to be back.
Hasn't growth in natural gas demand outpaced the growth in coal because it burns cleaner?
It has. That's one reason. Price is the other factor, of course. And the fact is, if you look at the price of natural gas, it started to recover over the last 12 to 18 months. So utilities that are able to shift easily between coal and natural gas as fuel for electricity have, to some degree, shifted back to coal in the last year. So according to some of the estimates I've heard in January, coal as a share of overall U.S. electricity generation climbed back up to 44%, which is close to its sort of historic levels.
Oh, because I had read that the International Energy Agency forecast global coal demand at 2.3% for the next 5 years, down from 3.4% growth that occurred over the previous 5 years.
So you have to separate what's happening in the world between the OECD and the non-OECD, or the developed world and the developing world. There's no question that the use of coal in North America, in Western Europe, and even in parts of East Asia like South Korea is going to go down over the next 10 to 20 years. But that is outweighed by what's happening in the developing world, particularly India and China, both of which are growing. Their economies are growing rapidly, and they really, at this moment, while they're making pretty strong efforts to develop other sources of electricity, coal is still the overwhelming primary source for power in those countries. And unfortunately, it looks to continue to be that for another 20 to 30 years at least.
And the United States is still the largest repository of coal in the world?
That's right. It's really interesting to go up to the Powder River Basin, which is in southeast Wyoming, and just see the scale of the operations up there. There's about a dozen mines in the basin, and these are, they're not underground mines like you think of when you picture a coal mine from the 1930s in Appalachia. These are huge, scraped-off hillsides, essentially, with some of the largest machines in the world that are just scraping the earth off and dumping the ore into huge trucks and carrying it to the loadout and dumping it in a train, and it never stops, it never slows down, and they have plenty of coal left. And of course, as you know, there's a huge debate going on right now and really a struggle over whether we are going to continue to produce and burn the carbon that's represented in those coal reserves. And to be frank, if we do, we have very little hope of limiting global climate change.
Now, what's happened in Appalachia? Has coal pretty much become a thing of the past?
Not yet. It's on its way, certainly. I was there back in September. I drove from Kingsport, Tennessee, down in the eastern corner of Tennessee, all the way up through eastern Kentucky and West Virginia to Charleston. And I talked to one guy who said he was the last independent coal miner shipping coal out of Harlan County in Kentucky, which Harlan County, of course, was the subject of the famous film and so on. And when you see those communities, Leonard, they've just been completely abandoned. And what's happened is the coal that's coming out of Wyoming is so cheap, and it's also relatively low sulfur, so it meets some of the EPA emissions requirements for air pollution, that it's actually less expensive for a utility in, say, Philadelphia to ship coal by rail from Wyoming than to buy it from Appalachia, which can be, you know, less than 100 miles away.
Wyoming is not the first place I would think of in terms of coal. I think about cattle when I think of Wyoming. But obviously, this is a particularly rich source of coal. Is it the kind of coal that Barack Obama was talking about when he ran for president the first time and said what we need is clean coal? Is there such a thing?
Well, those are two different questions. So clean coal, as it's usually used, is it really refers to the technology of burning the coal and attempting to capture the carbon that is produced out of the smokestack and sequestering that, which means burying it far underground. That's known as carbon capture and sequestration. There's a lot of efforts both in the U.S. and elsewhere, particularly in China, to develop that technology. I've written quite a bit about that technology, and I'm a skeptic just because it adds so much to the cost of electricity. To get back to the coal itself, the actual rock that comes out of the ground, yes, Wyoming coal is relatively cleaner than, say, coal that comes out of Appalachia or coal that comes out of Indonesia and is shipped to China. It's got lower sulfur, but that does not change the fact that coal is by far the most carbon-intensive fuel on Earth. So the level of carbon emissions in terms per unit of energy produced, coal far outstrips anything else, including natural gas.
I'm speaking with Richard Martin, whose article, Big Coal's Last Stand, is in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine, currently on newsstands, author of a forthcoming book called Cold Wars, to be published by Palgrave Macmillan. You write about Bill Veal, a veteran miner, to open your piece. What is his life like? He, as you suggested earlier, is not going down into the old idea of a coal mine.
Bill Veal actually is a heavy machinery operator. He runs one of the big shovels, which scrape the ore off the side of the canyon, as it were, that the larger machines have created, and loads it onto these gigantic haul trucks. The actual shovel on his machine can hold four VW bugs in it, and it holds hundreds of tons of coal. And so he's in the cockpit with a couple of joysticks manipulating this thing. And the thing to remember is these are good jobs, Leonard. You know, these people up in Wyoming get paid well. You know, Wyoming has always been a boom and bust energy economy. And for the last 10 years or so, the production of coal out of Wyoming by companies like Peabody Energy and Arch Coal has continued to rise. And these people have no interest in, you know, giving up their jobs and trying to retrain for some mythical new energy economy, because the coal industry has treated that part of the country very well.
And I'm assuming they don't have to deal with things like black lung disease.
That's right. I mean, it's a much, you know, as compared to that traditional image we all have of miners crawling into holes in the ground in Appalachia, it's a much cleaner way of producing coal. But again, it's so relative to, you know, burning natural gas, producing natural gas, even transporting natural gas. Obviously, we've got a lot of controversy over some of the pipelines for both natural gas and the oil that's coming out of Canada. And I think one thing that, as we continue to wrestle with the issues around energy production and climate change, we're going to have to get a lot better at gauging risk. And the risk of putting a pipeline from Canada to feed markets in the southern U.S. is nothing compared to the risk of continuing to build coal plants at a rapid pace in China.
Does the use of heavy machinery add to the carbon output of these mines?
It does, but amazingly enough, most of those machines, they either run on diesel, which of course is not a clean fuel, but the biggest machines, the huge drag lines that actually create these big holes that are then scraped by the shovels, they're actually electric, and I saw the world's biggest extension cord literally running from the back of this gigantic machine the size of a, you know, 8-story office building to a generator, and you don't want to, you know, unplug that cord.
Doesn't China have fairly large coal deposits itself? Why are they dependent on American coal?
Well, I wouldn't say they're dependent, but they became a net coal importer a few years ago simply because they can't keep up with the demand. And they import coal from Indonesia. They import coal from Australia. And now the real conflict at the heart of the Fortune story is over increasing exports from Wyoming, shipping it by rail west to the Pacific Northwest and then loading it on ships and taking it to China. And a lot of people will tell you that in terms of actually grappling with the issues around global climate change, all we're doing, it's like shipping our garbage to China. Now we're shipping our carbon emissions to China. And the other thing about China is its coal industry is still straight out of, you know, the 1950s, and it's very dirty, and people, the rate of fatalities in the Chinese coal mining industry is just astronomical. They don't have the basic limitations on air pollution that we've instituted over the last 30 or 40 years. And so I'm going to China next month. There's a big coal conference in Shanghai, and then I'm going up to Shaanxi province, which is really the coal heartland, the Appalachia, as it were, of China. And there are really smart people really dedicated to finding a way to transition China away from dirty coal towards cleaner sources of energy. But it's going to take a long time.
Now, there has been resistance throughout the country, the United States, to trains that transport oil. But what about those long coal trains? They don't present any danger, do they?
Depends on how you define danger. If you drive south from Boulder, where I live, down toward Golden, Colorado, you can see in the foothills to the west, there's a couple of railways, and you'll see these long coal trains that have 100 to 125 cars behind them, and the coal actually overtops the top of the car, and they've developed what they call the bread loaf shape of the surface of the coal that's being shipped. And there's a certain amount of controversy about how much coal dust blows off those trains. And, for instance, the people in the Pacific Northwest who, in terms of local officials and local groups, tend to be very vehemently opposed to these expanded coal exports. We'll show you some figures on the levels of coal dust as the train passes through town, et cetera. And that's a bit of, that's a contentious debate about how much there actually is.
And then there is resistance to building coal export terminals along the West Coast.
Exactly. So the danger, as it were, or the downside, is really in terms of the congestion that the trains themselves are going to create going through these small towns in inland Washington State and Idaho and Oregon, and also these gigantic terminals that they want to build. And so the coal industry, along with the railway industry and some investors, have proposed a total of 6 large shipping facilities or coal terminals on the West Coast between Vancouver, British Columbia, and San Francisco. 3 of those have already been shot down. And when we talk about a last stand, and people in the Sierra Club say things like this is a fight to the death for big coal, it's because they may not be able to build those terminals. Local opposition is strong enough that they may simply not get the approvals. And if they don't, they're going to have a lot of surplus production coming out of Wyoming that really has no place to go, because the demand, as you pointed out earlier, the demand in the U.S. is going to go nowhere but down.
My guest is Richard Martin. His article, Big Coal's Last Stand, is in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine, which is on the newsstands now. He's also the editorial director of Navigant Research and the author of a number of books. We talked to him not long ago about his book, Superfuel, Thorium, the Green Energy Source for the Future. His a book that is scheduled to come out in 2015 is Coal Wars, which will be published by Paul Gray Macmillan. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Richard Martin, whose article, Big Coal's Last Stand, is in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine. So you mentioned that a number of the coal export terminals along the West Coast have... Okay, well, we just lost our guest. He'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about what's been happening with big coal. The United States produced a lot of it, but now because of resistance in some areas, it has... we've been exporting most of it. I hear you back, Mr. Martin?
Yes.
You mentioned that the coal export terminals, some of them have been shot down. Who's shooting them down?
Well, it's a coalition of local government officials, including the mayor of Seattle and most of the Washington congressional delegation, the big national environmental organizations, Native American groups, local officials along the rail routes, and so on. And one thing I say in the story is that this issue of expanding coal exports has galvanized the environmental community in a way that we haven't seen since the whole controversy over logging in the Spotted Owl back in the late 80s.
But doesn't coal have a lot of friends in Congress? We hear criticisms of the president because they say he's engaging in a war on coal.
Absolutely, coal has a lot of friends. And one thing I want to stress is that this is not a black and white issue. You know, when the environmental community rails against big coal and treats the executives at coal companies like Peabody and Arch as if they're tobacco executives, we're forgetting that coal fueled the Industrial Revolution. Coal brought America most of its power up until very recently. And so I personally enjoy having the lights on and so on. And so I think we need to be a little less strident and a little less hypocritical in treating coal as the enemy. Most definitely, we need to reduce our dependence on coal, and we need to find a way to help China do so as well. Or, again, the fight against global climate change is more or less over. But
and it's not just climate change. China's facing extremely unhealthy levels of air pollution, especially in urban areas along its east coast and in Beijing, to the point where sometimes it looks like something thicker than the old London fogs.
Yeah, and if you remember back in the early part of the 20th century, if you looked at the air in Pittsburgh, the air in London, the air in Detroit, it often looked much the same. And so there's a sort of curve that communities and societies go through of increasing pollution and energy intensity and so on. And then, as has happened in this country, those levels tend to go down over time. But that's a multi-decade process. And in China, as I mentioned earlier, there's certainly a growing and vibrant community of people that want to reduce their dependence on coal. But the Chinese government has a very sharp dilemma in that they need these continued high rates of economic growth of 7 to 8% to really keep their billion people from getting restless, frankly. And right now, the only way to do that is to continue to supply coal-fired power.
Despite the fact that it causes many health problems, I guess we're thinking long-term and short-term here?
Exactly. Short-term, it's very hard to see a way out of this dilemma. Long term, there are many encouraging signs. I mean, just coming back to the U.S. for a moment, our carbon emissions actually went up slightly for the first time in a few years in 2013, but we're still below the level of 2005. So this can be done, but simply the magnitude and the scale of the challenge in a place like China, not to mention India, is it's hard to sort of fathom.
Well, you mentioned that Peabody's and I guess other coal companies as well, their future profitability is dependent on one key trend, and that is that coal use in China keeps rising indefinitely. Well, that sounds like it's not going to happen.
Well, if you talk to Wall Street analysts, for instance, they are becoming less and less convinced that it's going to happen. In my reporting for the story over the last couple of months, a couple of the major investment banks have come out with reports talking about peak coal in China, that, in fact, the level of coal use is going to start to plateau much sooner than some people are projecting. That would be a great thing for the world's climate. It wouldn't be so good for companies like Peabody and Arch that really are looking to overseas markets to continue to grow.
Are there Chinese risk management firms similar to America's Navigant where you work?
Well, sure there are. But the thing is, if you think of, I'm going to answer that question in a slightly different way. If you talk to the NGOs, the environmental organizations like Greenpeace and the Environmental Defense Fund and the World Resources Institute, et cetera, they all have offices in Beijing. But when I talk to them about what's going on at sort of the grassroots level in China and some of the local opposition that's springing up to some of these, continued development of coal plants, they don't get involved because they know that they are operating in China by the grace of the central government. And if they're seen to really side with these sort of grassroots opposition movements that are starting to spring up across China, it's going to be very hard for them to carry out their larger missions in the country. And just to answer that question in a larger way, absolutely, I've been in touch with, in preparation for my trip over there in April, I've been in touch with academics, with coal trading firms, with journalists, and so on. And really, the awareness of the issue of coal has taken a big leap just in the last couple of years, obviously from the levels of air pollution in the city, but more broadly, just kind of an understanding of where their power comes from, what the costs of continued dependence on coal are, and so on. And so it's very fascinating to watch this sort of grassroots, social media-fueled movement grow up in China that's really starting to have some success in limiting the continued development of the coal industry.
Did the financial collapse of 2007 have any impact on coal and the commodity markets?
Absolutely. In particular, it had an impact on the steel industry because a big portion of the coal consumed in China is what's called metallurgical coal, which is the coal you burn to smelt iron into steel. And so, as you know, the financial crash was sparked largely by a real estate crash, which limited new construction worldwide, which lowered the demand for steel, thus lowering the demand for coal in China. But looking back now, that looks like a sort of momentary hiccup, and those levels have continued to climb. One thing I will say, going back to the West for a moment, the levels of energy use per capita are actually starting to plateau and in some cases go down. So in other words, if you look at average energy use per American per year, that's actually at a level below that of about 2008. And we've never seen that before. That line has just kept climbing ever since, you know, the turn of the 20th century. And so that's an encouraging sign that we can still have prosperity and economic growth while starting to reduce the energy inputs that we depend on.
Is this a trend that will continue in other countries as well?
Well, again, there, not to get too deep into economics, but there's something called the Kuznets curve, which looks at the levels of, among other things, the environmental Kuznets curve looks at the level of pollution and the intensity of energy use. And every country that's ever been studied, every economy that's ever been looked at has gone through that curve. And once you get past that peak, yes, they start to go down. When is that going to happen in a country like China? If it's 2050, we're all in big trouble.
My guest is Richard Martin. His article, Big Coal's Last Stand, is in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Thopate. How responsive was Peabody Energy's president and CEO, Greg Boyce, to being interviewed about this?
Actually, quite cooperative. And I want to say, frankly, my thanks to Peabody. They are in a tough situation. You know, if you look at what happened with the tobacco companies, tobacco went from being a ubiquitous part of our life to being something that was shunned and virtually criminalized in a relatively short period of time. And now the coal producers are kind of going through a similar situation. But they want their story out. And, you know, I'm an environmentalist, but I don't believe we can simply make this kind of transition and leap without taking into account not only, obviously, the corporations that you know, are publicly traded and are a big part of our economy, but more importantly, the people who work there, the coal miners in Appalachia who have already been abandoned. And so, you know, companies like Peabody are not wholly admirable in my view. And if you look at what Peabody has done in the eastern U.S., they spun out their Appalachian units into a company that was basically created to abandon their pension obligations to the miners who had worked there for 30 years. So there's definitely some things going on that it's hard to respect. But at the same time, if you look at the portion of our economy that is fueled by coal, the number of multiplier jobs, and so on, it's going to be very difficult to make this transition in a way that's not going to disrupt our economy unless we do it in a thoughtful and pretty phased manner.
Has the Coal Miners Union lost most of its power?
Well, yes. That has tracked more or less with the decline of organized labor more generally in this country. Again, these tend to be good jobs, but if you look at some of the communities in Appalachia that I drove through a couple of months ago, there is nothing there. There is nothing else for those people to do. And we have to, as a society, we owe an obligation to those people. And so whether they're part of a union that's steadily losing power or not, you know, President Obama needs to go visit those people and needs to provide them with some hope.
Also, haven't they had another kind of environmental problem with mountaintop removal to mine for coal? All of the stuff is dumped in below and has polluted rivers, has despoiled farmland. Is that something that the coal mining industry takes any responsibility for?
Well, they're being forced into taking some responsibility for it, but in general, I would say, you know, they're trying to avoid that whenever possible. Again, if you're on the ground in Kentucky and West Virginia, you'll get a different story than what you hear in the national press. A lot of the people there say that mountaintop removal is not as bad as it sounds, and they haven't seen the effects, you know, and I really believe that depends on where you're standing, right? And I will tell you that there is a movement going on, and I'm going to be writing about this in my book. There is a movement going on to reuse those sort of what are now plateaus and used to be rolling mountains as industrial sites, as agricultural sites, and it's a movement that's in its infancy, but there's a lot of really smart and dedicated people trying to think about, okay, how can we reuse this land that has essentially been mined out and abandoned to provide some kind of economy and jobs for the people who still live here?
Well, listen, Alpha Resources, didn't it just pay $27.5 million in fine violations? They're one of the nation's largest coal producers and producers of dirty water.
That's right. It's very hard to produce coal without polluting the streams, the air, and so on. And that's another shift that's happened. If you're looking at the coal industry overall and you're thinking about the future of the coal industry, financial and otherwise, you have to take into account these mounting legal challenges and obligations from federal regulators and state regulators. If you look at the legendary Tennessee Valley Authority, which was formed in the 1930s as part of the New Deal to bring power and prosperity to the Southeast, they were hit with a huge judgment in a class action suit that was initiated by the state of North Carolina, joined by the EPA and some of the environmental groups, and they have essentially agreed to shut down the bulk of their, or I should say a large portion of their coal-fired plants over the next 10 years, mostly as a result of this lawsuit, which had to do with cross-state air pollution. And so if you're running the TVA, you have to take this into account. How are we going to craft a strategy that takes into account these lingering pollution issues, not to mention the future carbon emissions from the coal we produce? And in that sense, it really is a brand new world for some of these coal mining companies as well as the utilities that burn coal.
Well, coal and oil producers, like the Koch brothers, for example, or people in Congress who represent states where coal and oil come from, tend to be among the most outspoken climate change deniers. Is Peabody a climate change denier?
They were at one time. Peabody's chief lobbyist in D.C. is a guy named Fred Palmer, who's quite a colorful fellow. And a few years ago, he was fond of making some pretty outrageous statements, including that burning coal and producing carbon is doing God's work. And they have sort of muted that line of argument, I think, as that, as the argument, the debate over climate change has gotten more and more one-sided, and it's more and more clear that the scientific evidence is all pointing towards human activity as really having an effect on the world climate. What Peabody has done is rather clever, actually. What they said is, perhaps we have a global climate change problem in the future. We have a problem right now of 1 billion people in this world who have no access to electricity and running water. What are we going to do about them? So it's this sort of masterful PR move of allying the interests of this big coal company with the masses of Asia who have no source of reliable power. And as an argument, it's hard to argue with. Yes, there are people in Western China and in India and villages where they have 2 hours of power a day. So it's somewhat presumptuous of the West to say, we're not going to allow you to have the kind of development that we've gone through because we're worried about the future of the climate.
Richard, we have very little time, but I was wondering if there are any other uses for coal other than burning it. Is there something else that we could be doing with this abundance of natural resources that we have available to us?
Well, the answer is yes. One of the things you can do is known as gasification, and you create something called syngas, which can be burned at a lower rate of carbon emissions, and it's more versatile than just burning coal. So you can produce energy from it. Theoretically, you could use it in transportation and so on. Again, that's a very complicated and controversial subject in terms of the amount of energy that has to go into the conversion from solid coal to syngas and sort of how, whether you can make money on it, whether it really reduces emissions, and so on. So I would say that's a topic we can get into in another show once the book comes out.
And it's more expensive than corn?
Yes, it is. In many ways, it could have benefits as compared to corn-based ethanol.
Richard Martin's article, Big Coal's Last Stand, is in the March 17th issue of Fortune magazine. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Good to talk to you.
And I look forward to receiving your book.
You certainly will.